Simple Beep, episode 54, The Newton Community. Hello, and welcome to Simple Beep, a podcast looking back at the history of Apple and the Newton community on today's episode. So last episode, we talked about the history of the Newton, the creation of the project, and the various pieces of hardware that were part of the Newton series and the Newton platform. And we got a lot of follow-up from a lot of Newton enthusiasts. So this episode, we've actually brought some of those people onto the show to tell us more about the Newton, maybe some things that we missed, and their experiences with the Newton, and how the Newton still does have an active community around it. Before we get to that, first, we have a couple quick pieces of follow-up, and the first one is about one of the Newton devices.
Yes, in our episode, I mentioned that the eMate had the same sized screen as the 2000 series message pads that were released around the same time. But this is incorrect. While they had the same resolution, which is where I draw my foolish assumption from, the eMate screen size was noticeably bigger. Some sources say that the eMate was around 6.8 inches, I believe, on the diagonal. And through some Pythagorean theorem, the 2000 series was around 5.9.
So it's kind of a reverse iPad mini type situation, where same number of pixels, different density.
Yeah.
And one other quick piece of follow-up, not Newton-related, but it was about something that we talked about last episode, was we put a link to a Kickstarter project for cancel and save notepads that have the classic Mac cancel and save style buttons at the bottom with Chicago font. And the Kickstarter was funded. And so if you supported that, you're going to be getting a lovely little notepad in the mail. And I filled out my Kickstarter info survey today, like where should it be shipped? And it had some follow-up questions. So it sounds like if you didn't back the Kickstarter, you haven't entirely missed out, because it sounds like he wants to not only continue producing these at a cost that is effective for to be a business and a product, but also looking into other things like maybe smaller ones like sticky note size ones and related products. So I think that's going to be a cool little line of products that will continue into the future as long as Apple doesn't bring the ban hammer down on it. So now let's get into our discussion for today. And like I said, we have a couple of guests on the show. So first, I'd like to welcome Jake Bordens.
Hi there. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And we also have Thomas Brand, a.k.a. Egg Freckles.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So you know that you're in the company of Newton experts when their Twitter handles and websites are in jokes about the Newton. So we definitely feel like this is a great group to have together to talk about what the Newton was like and what the Newton community is like today. So just to start off, we wanted to ask you when you actually got involved with the Newton. So we talked last episode that the Newton series began in 93, ran through the late 90s. But when did you first get your hands on a Newton?
Well, I had just graduated high school, and a friend of mine and I went to, it was called PC Expo back then, at the Jacob Javits Convention Center in New York City. And actually, there was an upstairs room that I think it was called Mac OS Expo, which had most of the Apple-related stuff, but Apple had really invested in a large presence on the main show floor for the Newton. And both my friend and I kind of fell in love with the device, and we went home and immediately figured out how we could each get our own. And I think, you know, they were pretty expensive, like with the keyboard and everything, it was like $1,200. So it was a pretty sizable investment for a couple kids just going into college. But, you know, I took all my notes in college on it, and, you know, it really became part of like my everyday workflow.
Was that a pretty out of the ordinary workflow for compared to what else was going on in your college classrooms?
Well, you know, I went to Carnegie Mellon University, so there was a lot of weird stuff going on, you know, robots running across campus and things like that. But, you know, it was very early in kind of the internet connected era. We had one of the first wireless networks. It was actually 2 megabit WaveLAN, if I recall back then. And, you know, so having a device on wireless was kind of unique at that point in time. This was like in the 1997 timeframe, but it was great. It did attract kind of you know, interested looks, but you know, it was short lived, unfortunately, because, you know, within a year, we started to hear the, spin-off rumors, and then they spun it off. And then shortly thereafter, when Steve came back, that was the end of the road.
And how about you, Thomas?
Well, I'm kind of late to the Newton game as well. I grew up with Macs like you guys, and I remember the Newton being announced at like Macworld 1993 in Boston, because I'm from the area. But I was, 10 or 11 at the time. It was a while before I actually got to experience using a message pad, aside from seeing them on X-Files. When I really first got exposed to it was actually when I started working as a Mac genius for Apple in around 2004. One of the guys that I went out for genius training when they used to ship the Mac geniuses out to Cupertino was this guy named David Getson, and he actually brought his message pad. Didn't bring a laptop, didn't bring, you know, a PowerBook or an iBook or anything. Brought his message pad, and that's what he took notes on the entire time during the training. And that was like my first time actually experiencing not only a new message pad, but I mean, this guy had it all tricked out. He had a wireless card, Bluetooth card. He was, sending email from it. He was doing all these things that I didn't, frankly, I was familiar with the product and the specs, but I didn't know it was possible. And that really got me interested in Newtons and message pads and the community at large.
That's kind of amazing. That's like living the iPad-only lifestyle before the iPad was even a thought.
If I remember right, they let you in those days, so you could get your Apple ID card taken, a picture taken, however you like it. And I think he had his taken with his holding his Newton.
So, Thomas, did you eventually acquire a Newton? And if so, like, did you try and trick it out to do similar things?
Yeah. So when I got back from training, I worked as a Mac genius for about a year or so. And during that time, the previous lead Mac genius at my store, he actually bought one. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm being surrounded by Newtons. And, it was kind of interesting seeing what you could do with them. And I was very interested in the whole using a Newton as a web server, not only just for the community, but I thought, wow, wouldn't this be interesting if I could have a blog and I could have it actually hosted on a Newton? And what if I made it look like a Newton? And that initial idea kind of failed pretty quickly because, believe it or not, a 167 megahertz message pad doesn't exactly hold well to web traffic. I ended up porting what I designed as a theme to a WordPress site and then some other different content management systems. But I guess the rest is history, because if I'm known for one thing on the internet, it's that I have a website that looks like a Newton.
My favorite thing about Egg Freckles is that it is a reactive design Newton. So that if you make it the window small enough for like a mobile dimensions, it pretends to just be the screen. And then if you pop out to a full desktop window, that you get a nice little hardware border around it. So I think the more modern approach definitely has its benefits as well.
Well, thank you. I mean, originally the site started out to try to emulate a Newton as much as possible. It had a drawer, it had sound effects, it has a backlight. It still has a backlight, but I was like, what am I doing this for? Am I doing this to share, to write, or to, emulate a Newton in HTML? And so it's kind of a happy medium right now.
Yeah, one of the people who wrote in, and we tried to get on this show, but the time differences were too large, was a Pavel Petrovsky, who is running or overseeing a similar effort of a network of Newtons acting as web servers. I think his the Twitter handle is at INDIGI_Newton, and there's a website that goes along with it, so we'll put that in the show notes. But some people are still trying to keep that dream alive.
It does seem like a pretty tough goal because, yeah, you're working within constraints of some pretty limited hardware, not just from the processing power of the device itself, but also from connectivity.
Right. I mean, the really cool aspect of it is the integration. So, yeah, you can host a website on it, and it's basically like a static website that people can visit. But the fact that they can actually post a message to your Newton and that you can like log on and see in the notes application, or that they can see a screenshot or actually like search the files on your Newton straight from a web page. That was the kind of integration that I always thought was intriguing. You know, what if you can make a website that looks like a Newton that actually has a Newton as the back end? And, you know, there's lots of jokes about hosting a website on everything from a computer to a toaster to whatever. But that kind of integration is something you don't normally see.
Right, because no one even goes around talking about like, oh, I'm going to host a website from my iPhone, even though that would be completely possible in terms of like always on network connectivity and processing power. It's just like not something that even in like the jailbreaking community seems to be a thing that people are really particularly interested in doing. So it does have some of that allure of just being a challenge. But yeah, those additional features of this service, the Newton personal data server, which I guess was just, it's built in, right?
Well, it's an application that you install. You know, this is the benefits of this whole Newton community is someone decided at some point this was something that they wanted to do and they made a package for it. I don't think anyone ever intended that the Newton, you know, message pad, the first personal data assistant, would actually be a web server. Because when the Newton was initially, you know, designed, it didn't have wireless networking or Ethernet. Now, Ethernet was something that Apple added in, but the fact that you could do a web server from it, this is something that the fans brought to the platform.
And that's one of the important things about the Newton in its heyday and now as a kind of homebrew and enthusiast community is the fact that it's a completely open platform as opposed to something like iOS.
Well, it's still limited by the fact that it's, you know, based on a proprietary software that's baked into a ROM that we have no control over. But it's amazing how far the community has gone at extending those capabilities or fighting against those restrictions. I mean, as I said, it's got Bluetooth. You can do wireless networking now. People are hosting web servers, but also people are emulating it in ways that it was never intended to emulate this OS on everything from Android to iOS to Linux to Mac OS X. So I'm just always been amazed at how far people have pushed the platform even after Apple turned out the lights.
It's one of the things that I find interesting is kind of the reverse engineering aspect of, you know, the ROM. And one of the things that like is still kind of surprising to me is we are talking about an ARM V6 processor. That's the same essential instruction set in the first iPhone. So a lot of the reverse engineering tools that, you know, you can get today for examining iOS binaries, disassemblers, and things like that work on a Newton assembly just as readily as they would on an iPhone binary. And so, you know, it's part of the fun is kind of doing that archaeology. And there was just a lot of really clever things that Apple did to make the device as functional and as feature rich as they did, given the constraints of ROM and flash and power that, you know, it's just amazing to some extent. And you can read some of the stories, some of the early Newtons where, you know, they had to patch them in the box and things like that. But by the time the message pad 2000 came around, and eventually the 2100, I mean, it was a pretty well-developed system with, not only, internet connectivity, but, even some other hardware accessories, It was a computer unto itself. I often wonder, you know, if it hadn't been canceled, where would it be? Yeah, I don't know that it would have ever, you know, survived to this day kind of thing. I mean, I think that there are still some constraints that maybe were just inherent in its design. But, you know, it was very unique for its time. I mean, you got to keep in mind that, like, competitor products were Palm Pilots with 16 megahertz processors, and this was 162 megahertz, 167.
162. I was wrong. You're right.
So yeah, the message pad 2000 had two PCM CIA slots because people wanted to have an added storage card as well as a connectivity card, whether that be a modem or an Ethernet card or eventually wireless. You know, there were computers back then that didn't even have two slots. Well, most computers didn't have two slots.
And now Apple makes computers with no slots and no ports.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you know, as you're aware, that you know, there was a third slot on the inside that was intended, I believe, for a modem, just a built-in modem that was never made by Apple. And you know, one of the really fun things is on the United Network of Newton Archives, UNNA.org, for those, and that's a site that hosts pretty much all of the packages and software that you know we have been able to dig up over the years. There are some documents from like design spec documents for the Newton, and some of them even have like a Apple Confidential stamp on them, which, you know, someone leaked them, and we thank that person, whoever it is, because I'd love to have more resources like that to look at. But yeah, it's like need to know Apple Confidential, and you know, you could just imagine, you know, when that was stamped, and you know, someone eventually got it out, whether it be one of the licensees or something, and that information is, you know, used to this day for people who are, you know, working on Einstein or other projects.
Yeah, somebody found it in their desk drawer in Apple in 2003 and went, yeah, this probably isn't that confidential anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always wonder, like, you know, are there troves of information out there that, you know, could find its way into the community? Because, you know, there is a lot of unique things that were made, unique hardware, you know, that... maybe didn't sell well, or you know, only one or two copies exist. So you know, if any of your listeners do have any kind of old Newton stuff, you know, there's a Newton Talk email list, newtontalk.net. You know, you can go on and say, hey, you know, I've got an old design spec for the Cirrus Logic Voyager chipset. We'd love to have it.
Yeah, we were hoping to have Grant Hutchinson, aka Splorp, who is one of the people who runs the Newton Talk list on the show. He had to he had a family conflict at last minute, and so he wasn't able to join us tonight. We hope to have him on the show sometime in the future. And one of the things I love about the Newton Talk website is that it does have this incredible blend of the classic and the modern. So if you go on their site, they have a mailing list FAQ page, and you click on that, and it's hosted on GitHub. And you know, this is pertaining to a list that's all about this technology from at least 20 years ago. And so it really is fun to see that sort of clash of old and new in that group.
Stepping back a little bit, we talked about the Newton's ability to connect outward onto networks and community efforts to kind of improve this. Jake, you even mentioned this rumored internal slot for the modem, and you have specific experience in building a Wi-Fi card for like modern networks that fit into this slot. Would you like to talk a little bit about that project?
Yeah, I mean, with the funny thing about the Newton is that, or with my personal experience with the Newton, is that like it always comes back. Like, you know, in college, by the end of my grad year, you know, it was in a drawer. And you know, then, you know, you find it in a drawer, you take it out, and it feels magical and new, just like it always did. And so, you know, in the early 2000s, sometime I tried to build a Bluetooth card for that slot, and I failed for various reasons, mainly because I didn't really know much about RF design, and I still don't. But nowadays you can get like commodity Wi-Fi modules, and the Newton's Internet Enabler really is designed for the Internet Enabler is the software that you use to connect to the internet. It's kind of the TCP/IP stack on the Newton, and it's really designed in an era of PPP dial-up. And so I did some research, and I found a commodity Wi-Fi module that had a built-in PPP server. So after packaging it on, you know, making a circuit board and some ancillary hardware, those specs I mentioned earlier really helped for the pinouts, and there were actually a couple errors that I found that kind of caused me to have to redesign things a couple times. But in the end, it's nothing complicated. It's just a, you know, essentially a The Newton thinks it's dialing up to an old PPP dial-up internet service provider, when in reality it's dialing up to this Wi-Fi module that is connected to your network. And it's useful because PCMCIA cards of the era didn't support WPA. Well, WPA2 wasn't even a thing yet. And later cards are card bus, and card bus is not compatible with the Newton. So pretty much you would either have to connect using an old WLAN or Orinoco card in the clear, and no one runs their Wi-Fi networks in the clear anymore.
Not a good idea these days.
Even, or, you know, WEP would work, but that's not secure either. So to have a module that allows you to connect to a modern network kind of does open up the ability to use it again and play with some of that software. And you know, but there are other problems that are still kind of limiting your ability to use the Newton. One of them is that there was never HTTPS, you know, the encryption stack on board. And that's a big project for someone to implement, and no one's really stepped up to the plate to do it. And I'm not even sure how you would hook it into the hardware stack. There are smarter people than I, you know, who know more about the Newton, like internals, but, you know, so, you know, a lot of sites, you know, you can't even get to because we're HTTPS everywhere now. And so like the web browsers and stuff, and there was never really a good JavaScript stack. And so you hit limitations. But, you know, if you're just trying to export your notes, you know, off your device, then it's a perfectly valid way to do it.
And did you say that when you first had a Newton that you actually did have some basic wireless networking on it?
Maybe by like the late 90s, like 1999, 1998. The WLAN, the Lucent, you know, the early 802.11b stuff started to come down to a price where you can afford it. And, you know, it did work. It was still, even with an Ethernet card, whether it be wireless or wired, it was still almost a dial-up metaphor where like the app would have to like, you know, start up and launch the Ethernet driver and connect and, you know, get your DHCP. And so it was still like transactional, for lack of a better way to say it. So that's part of the, I think, you know, what Tom was talking about before, the challenges with running a web server is that it wasn't like an always on internet stack like you expect on a modern device. It was like on demand, probably for battery, probably because, you know, modems were the way you did it most of the time. You know, you watch Under Siege and you see Steven Seagal with his Newton sending a fax. I mean, that's how it was, you know, intended to be used. So the funny thing about I don't run a web server, but I do know that there's another package that you can install with it that, you know, monitors the Newton, and when something stalls, it reboots and restarts, because that's the easiest way to keep your uptime is to just reboot. And, you know, maybe memory leaks, maybe other things eventually catch up with you. And then you reboot and, you know, you're back online.
Yeah. So you mentioned battery concerns. What was it like using a Newton as like a daily carry device? How did they fare in the world compared to the devices that we tend to carry around in our pockets now that we think of as kind of one day charge devices?
Oh, you could get a week easy. I mean, you weren't running big radios or anything like that. If you didn't use the backlight, the Newton had a battery tray where you could put regular alkalines in, or you could get a NiCad battery pack for it. You know, you could recharge it. Surprisingly good on the battery life, especially if you know, we're only using it a couple hours a day. I mean, it wasn't the ubiquitous connectivity device that, you know, modern iPhones are today.
I mean, if you try to run wireless on the batteries, you'll just watch your power go right out.
Yeah.
But that being said, I mean, the real marvel of all this is if you have a Newton and you put it in a drawer and it sits there for like 3 years and then you take it out and put fresh batteries in it, it still remembers everything that was on it. And that was pretty revolutionary for, devices of the time, a Palm Pilot or those early Palm devices, if they run out of battery power, they lose everything. You'd have to sync them back with your computer. And so even early on, the Newton was kind of a standalone device in that way. It's just another way that it was ahead of its time.
Yeah, and the transactional nature of the way the internet stack was, like if you went to send an email, it would connect to the internet, fire up the radios, send the email, and then disconnect. And so, you didn't really need to have, always on networking for the model. There's an app on the device called InOut, which was, again, built in an era where you would be disconnected for long periods of time, and you would want to queue up your outbox with maybe emails or other things. And then when you were connected, it would connect and, maybe suck down your mail from a POP server. And, so it was really designed for kind of this burst connectivity, because that's just the way things were.
Yeah. And I think that was an Apple feature that was included in many of their products, was the notion of having that battery backup, even in early Macs, having the battery that would keep the clock running even when the device was, totally out of battery in case of a PowerBook or if there was a power outage or something like that for a desktop. And that got them into trouble sometimes. I remember we had a PowerMac 6100 that had a bug with the battery, and if the battery went dead, you might not be able to start up the computer at all, which was kind of bad news, especially because they were those weird type of cells that you couldn't just go to the grocery and get a new one, and you certainly couldn't just order one off of Amazon in 1995 or whenever that happened. But yeah, that was one of the things that they prided themselves on, stood out. I think by the time that I got into any kind of PDA, and I was not a Newton person, I was a Palm person from high school and college, pre-iPhone. And I think that you could run them down at that point. It was some of the later devices, but it was definitely something that was pioneered by the Apple devices. And then other vendors realized that was a feature that they absolutely needed to include.
Some of the early Newtons, I never had one, but they actually did have a backup battery I think they even had like an elaborate like physical interlock that prevented you from removing both the battery and the backup battery, because if you removed both, then you would lose it. But the 2000 and 2100 both had flash, so you could leave it without a battery in the drawer, as Tom said, and fire it up, years later, and all your packages are there. Like the last, I found notes on mine, from college. They really had a robust kind of storage model, and one of the can't remember what show you guys were talking about, but it was the Quick Take discussion where you could send your Quick Take into Apple and have it upgraded. Well, they had a similar program for the 2000 where, you could send your 2000 into Apple, and they would, replace the main logic board with one that had the 4 megabytes of flash instead of the 1, which the 2000 had. So you basically got back a 2100. And I remember sending mine in, and I remember tormenting the poor people at the other end of the call center, just like, where's my Newton? Where's my Newton? Where's my Newton? Can you give me an update? Can you give me an update? Can you give me an update? But, it was definitely an interesting thing that, Apple provided you the ability to kind of upgrade this. And it was like almost less than a year then after the 2000 came out that they announced the 2100. So, I think it was a very rapid development cycle.
Yeah. I think on your blog detailing your the card you made, one of the things you had to do was replace a port cover to kind of accommodate the different internals. And I think you have a note that's like, this is where you would get the 2100 sticker if you went through this program.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a little sticker with green letters, the 2100. It was the only way you could really tell from the outside, other than looking at the about screen to see how much memory you had, how much flash storage you had. It was... it was a big difference. I mean, we're talking machines with 4 megabytes of storage. I mean, the packages, the software packages, you're talking like the largest one that I can remember is like in the 400K range. I'm sure they were bigger. But I mean, full featured software in 400K, and that back to like Apple having a really innovative way of building the architecture, you know, NewtonScript, the programming language, was designed in a with storage and being efficient in mind, so that, you know, large portions of the operating system could stay in read only memory, essentially burned into the system, and you know, you didn't have to like package a lot of frameworks or other associated code. It was like the bare minimum that you needed to compile and send for your app to really optimize the use of that limited storage.
It's all that same kind of clever hacks that made the original Macintosh possible, it sounds like.
Yeah, there's some really clever, I mean, it's just amazing to see some of the stuff. I mean, you know, they really went out of their way in some regards to optimize for the constraints. And, you know, even the like you said, I think I was reading that the processors that they used originally, some of the early models, they didn't go ARM originally. They were actually developing it for, I think you talked about this, the AT&T processor or whatever. And, you know, that's like a big series of hoops to jump through, you know, to maintain 2 code bases until the decision could be made. So they were really looking for the optimal, optimal design for their constraints.
So you're talking about these packages and the ability to add them. And you also mentioned that a lot of your uses were the typical PDA uses, notes, maybe calendar and those sorts of things. Were there any packages that were among your favorites or things that stood out or really extended the Newton when you were using it on a more regular basis?
Well, I can, I think I found a post, I don't know if it was on your blog, Tom, but someone was talking about some of the software that a company called Tactile made. They made some pretty high quality Newton software. There was an FTP client, which was very useful. There was a gentleman named Adam Tao. I think his website's still up, tao.com, T-O-W. Apologize if I'm pronouncing the name wrong. He had some really great software. He had an app called Hypernewt, which was essentially an enhanced notes app with tagging and foldering that, you know, allowed you to do a lot more with your Newton and organizing large volumes of notes. Very, you know, not quite wiki-like, but, you know, kind of a early precursor. There were games. I don't know, Tom, did you have any favorites?
What was it called? Not Battleship, Subhunt. That was a great one. For the most part, though, you know, a lot of people would extend it with dashboards or little extra dock things or the ability to have a background desktop pattern. And I almost always kept mine just as it was, you know, just with the bare minimum in terms of software that I needed to extend the device's original capabilities. So, like, I used to install things like printer drivers that would let me print to a LaserJet printer over the IR, so I could, you know, walk into a classroom or some of the printers that they had at work and point my crazy huge PDA at it and print out documents. I don't know. I impressed myself. Things like, you know, the ability to get online, but to send mail from any note. One of the great things about the just regular built-in Newton OS was that it kind of had this document-centric model where if you wrote a note and you wanted to share it, you could send that note as a fax, or you could email it, or you could beam it. And that was all built in as a what they called routes, but it was kind of like a precursor to iOS's share sheets way back in the 90s. And so, you know, I can't say I extended my Newton or have extended it. I still use it, but with that much additional software, just kind of little tweaks and things that allow me to get the notes off my message pad or to, you know, send them to people in different ways.
Yeah, the more you were talking about that, I was thinking the same thing, share sheet. And kind of the more that I learn about the Newton OS, the more echoes of it that I see in iOS. And even even in things where like we're still adding to iOS, you know, iOS is a mature platform now, 10 years old, but like the things that people are talking about on podcasts now, talking about what the latest versions of iOS can do and what could be added in the future. Some of these same kind of things keep coming up, or things like, you know, advanced notes management, like, you know, listen to any Apple podcast of the past couple months as we're recording this in February of 2017. And they'll be talking about, oh, Bear is this great new advanced notes app that you can use to organize your notes better. And it's almost wiki-like. You can link between notes. And it's like, it's just the same thing over and over. It's that, you know, I mean, obviously, one of the big advantages that we've had in 20 years is the miniaturization of the hardware and lots of fit and finish and polish and computing power. But the fact of it comes down to that once you have a handheld device, you still want to do the same kind of things on it.
I mean, from my perspective, the Newton was, I think, a trailblazer in the fact that it did not have a headphone port.
There you go. Lightning only.
Well, one of the things that I really liked about the, you know, really like about the Newton platform that you don't see today is, as I was saying, that document-centric model. You start a, you know, a modern computer or a smartphone and you see the sea of apps in front of you. But with the Newton, typically you start it and you go back to the last note that you were taking. And that content, as I said, could be delivered as a note or a fax. It could be emailed. But just the idea of having like this data structure that you created yourself with simple gestures of drawing across the screen to create a new note or scribbling to cross things out. And that data was infinitely shareable or expandable across, well, maybe not infinite, you know, the Newton had its limitations, but you weren't limited to a specific app or sandbox. You could take this data and use it in different ways, all from a single application that put your data first. And that's just something you don't generally see nowadays, where we have, you know, applications and sandboxes and kind of information silos.
Yeah, that idea of data portability and the fact that, yeah, that sounds a little bit more Mac-like, but even on the Mac, I mean, I know that I rely on third-party utilities to achieve a lot of that same kind of portability. Like, I'm a heavy Launch Bar user, and I know that I can select pretty much anything and invoke Launch Bar and then send it somewhere else. But I also know that even other savvy Mac users who see me moving files and text and images and stuff around that way kind of look over my shoulder and go, How are you doing that? What's the glue here? An advanced concept that was present on the Newton.
Well, it also sounds like OpenDoc, which was like around the same time as the height of the Newton, or maybe right as the Newton was shut down, the kind of document-centric model. And Apple tried to bring this to the Mac and get widespread acceptance, but I don't think it ever went very far.
And that was another project that was axed upon the return of Steve Jobs. So there you go.
The whole platform, even, you know, as a developer who still pokes around in there sometime, like the whole platform is very open in that with very, very basic, very freely available tools, you can navigate the whole structure of not only the storage, but the applications themselves. So it's very easy to, you know, patch or change or edit. It's a bad analogy, but you can imagine, you know, if your entire operating system was essentially running something like a JavaScript engine, back to maybe your widgets episode, and, you know, you could fire up a text editor and edit, you know, the code. It's not quite that easy, but it is very open. And to some extent, that was great because you can do a lot of things. But I also know that it was a frustration for people who had intellectual property that they were trying to protect. And so, you know, the openness of the platform sometimes made it difficult for, like, you know, there was a cat and mouse game from shareware at the time. And I know some of the developers were very unhappy with that cat and mouse game. They found it hard to monetize their apps. Same problems today in a different form, but monetization was a problem. It really does like lend itself to kind of that exploration and that reverse engineering now, years later, And I think that's one of the reasons that people still poke around with it, because it's fun to learn and see how things were implemented. And you can do that in ways that, like, a closed platform like iOS, you just can't.
Hey, that's the real reason why the Newton had two PC card slots. So much of the software was only available on PC cards. So if you want to have that in your modem or your own backup card, you needed to.
Yeah.
But on the subject of, technologies that you see today, I mean, there was the assistant feature, which was an early attempt at natural language processing. So you would write a note like, lunch with Tom at 2 p.m. on Thursday at Apple Cafe, and you hit the assist button and it would make a calendar entry for you, or at least try to. It had very, I imagine, limited syntax, but those are features you see in apps like Fantastical and Siri today. The Newton interconnect port, there was a 26 pin connector, very similar to what eventually became the 30-pin connector. I don't know if they were related, but very similar looking at the very least. And, had multiple, had audio, had power in and out, had had multiple serial channels, very similar to what eventually found its way onto the iPod. I don't know if they were related in any meaningful way, but, from the outside, they look very similar.
Yeah, it seems like even just having the institutional memory of some of these Newton features around, even when the product is axed later on, people just, they know what can be done with the various bits of hardware and software, and those kind of things aren't forgotten and work their way back into later projects where they've become useful to us now.
Yeah, I mean, on Newton Talk the List, you'll see, like, whenever Apple announces a new feature that has any relation to something that Newton had, you get, hey, look, what's old is new. Here we go again. And, skeuomorphism was, used in the Newton. I know that it's, out of vogue now. When you would delete a note, it would crumple it up into a little ball and throw it in the trash bin. Or those share sheet, the routing menu that we talked about earlier, when you'd send an email, a little envelope would come up and you would address, you would pick the address on where you would put the address. And if you had multiple email accounts, you would select the return address where the return address would be. And then you'd hit send and it would fly off the screen. And, it was sparingly used. I mean, we couldn't have, a whole lot of that in 4 megabytes of ROM or 8 megabytes of ROM, whatever it was. I still delete things just for the fun of seeing the animation. It's almost similar to, in iOS, actually. Another, if you delete an email in iOS, it gets kind of sucked down into the trash bin. Well, that's, I think Newton did it first.
Do you remember waiting in line for the first iPhone? I wasn't going to buy one. I was waiting with friends. Yeah, that worked out real well. I bought one on day one. But it was crazy. We were sitting in lawn chairs, and I had my message pad, and I was actually sitting there in the line doing the, waiting game, about to buy a phone for $600 that we had never touched, never held before. And after I had bought it, there were these display tables, and I got to sit down or stand with an iPhone for a couple minutes while my friends were like checking out. And I remember going to the Notes app and emptying the trash and seeing that animation and realizing that I could type with my fingers and that I really didn't need a stylus, and thinking, oh my God, this thing is amazing. And a lot of that, amazing was kind of like, this is the next step from the message pad, the Newton that I had been using up until this point. So I totally agree that there's some evolution and some knowledge that was kept on how to, make these devices that carried on to things like the iPod and potentially the iPhone, maybe not directly, but kind of in the spirit, that proved useful to Apple.
Yeah, I still hope, I think a lot of old Newton users hope that handwriting recognition will eventually make a comeback. I mean, it had a very bad start and, got a very bad reputation, but by the end, it really was very serviceable. I mean, I took notes in class, and, once you learn some basic gestures. I mean, even to this day, I remember, in the early versions of iOS when it didn't have cut and copy, I hoped that, the Newton style gestures for cut and copy would come back, because I just thought they were so great. What you would do is you would hold the pen down at the start of your selection, and you would and after it was held down for an instant, it would turn into an ink blot, and then you would drag that across your selection, and you would basically highlight like it was as if your pen was a highlighter. And then once your text was highlighted, you would grab the text and drag it to the edge of the screen, and it would stick to the edge of the screen like Fitz's law, like very quick, like you can just flick this text to the side of the screen, and it would stick a small little tag to the side of to the corner of your screen or wherever you put it. And then it would be there. And when you needed it back, you would just drag it from the screen and drop it where you wanted it. So you could switch apps, you could do whatever you needed to do. And, to this day, I think that's one of the most clever gestures in the operating system, because it's something you do all the time. It leverages the fact that you the edge of the screen is a fast place to dock things. And, it was just like seamless in the workflow. And yeah, every time I have to cut and paste text in iOS, I just wince a little.
It's still brutal.
It's terrible. And, it's like, I know it wouldn't necessarily be a perfect, application of that gesture. With the pencil, it would be, but, I feel like it's a problem that we still haven't solved, years and years later.
Yeah, you mentioned getting good at writing on the Newton, and maybe this will be a point for me to bring up my non-Newton ways. But I think that if you put a Palm device back in front of me, I could just I would start immediately writing in graffiti again. Like I learned that system and it was fairly natural to me. Although you said, the copy and paste gestures, I feel like there were gestures and I couldn't not in any way, shape or form recall what those were, because they were not intuitive in that same way that the Newton clearly was. So did either of you use any of the competition in this era or later on?
I had a handspring visor, and I completely agree with you. Like Jeff Hawkins, the one of the founders of Palm and started the handspring company, he I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said, which do you think is easier, teaching a human to write in graffiti on a device that has limited capabilities, or teaching a limited device to understand the diversity of human handwriting? And he definitely got that right. The Newton was... it was a huge challenge to have it recognized script or handwriting off the bat. And they definitely improved. But that is something that, once you learn graffiti, you could probably go back and do it. And, maybe they were right.
Yeah. I mean, that is a tough problem. Even teaching a human to read someone else's handwriting. I mean, I work in education, and sometimes even today at work had to see handwritten paper from a student that I've never met before. And, you're supposed to be looking at, how good is their writing? That is the content of their writing, not how good is their handwriting, which is atrocious and almost illegible. and so, yeah, it's definitely turning the problem sideways is a easier way to make a quick win on that.
My wife actually makes fun of my handwriting, and, not to be, to broadly stereotype, but she says I have the handwriting of a little girl, and I actually blame the Newton, because I write very neatly, you wanted to reduce handwriting recognition errors. So it trained me, but I mean, it's not a bad thing. It's just, I lost some of the sloppiness because I, didn't want to have to go back and correct. And there were nice gestures for correcting when you made a mistake. You could quickly and easily, fix errors. But, it was much more efficient just to write legibly, and it would get your handwriting like 98-99% of the time. Unless it was some really weird word or something that was not in your dictionary. Yeah, it definitely worked by the end. And, you know, it gets a bad rap with egg freckles and the Simpsons jokes, but rightfully so for some of those early models. But, you know, it definitely came a long way by the time it reached its end state.
Do either of you still regularly interact with a Newton today, whether on an original piece of hardware or through any of the emulation projects?
So I still have message pads on my desk. I still use my message pad 130, which is like my favorite model. It's the thinner kind of, not thinner, but not as wide, taller message pad. The one that was famously designed by Johnny Ive. And it's the more powerful of that form factor. And it's, you know, it can't get online. It can't really do wireless networking, but it can, it's really good at taking notes, and it has a backlight, and it has a regular Mac serial port, so you can plug the Newton keyboard right into it. And that's the thing that I take with me at work to meetings and take notes on. And when I'm done with those notes, I actually beam them to a 2100 message pad that is connected via Wi-Fi. And so that's like how I get my mail, is I beam it to that, and that sends the email. It's totally strange and eccentric, but
yeah, I still have a bunch of devices here. I think I have, I still have my original message pad from 1996. It's an upgraded 2100. It's pretty beat up. But I bought a couple other, ones on eBay over the years as they, you know, if I saw a really good deal on one, I'd grab it. Bought a couple of eMates just last year, because I wanted to see what one was like, because I never had really experienced one. But I'm a contributor to the Einstein Project, and do some work on that from time to time, and build I built a Objective-C bridge for Einstein, so that, you know, with a Newton package can call out to Objective-C. So that was necessary, because if you wanted to say email a note, you know, you needed a way to bridge the gap across the emulated to the base OS. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I added to Einstein. But working on a sound bug that causes the sound not to play correctly sometimes, and some other things that I haven't really tracked down. But, you know, it's part of the fun, like I said, of reverse engineering and figuring out how did this work, and, you know, how does the sound work, or how does the emulator itself work? It's just a learning experience. So when I have free time, I poke around.
Yeah, and that project just celebrated a pretty big milestone release as we record, I think, just a week ago.
Yeah, I know. Steven posted a binary, which, it was probably long overdue, but, it was always serviceable if you compiled it yourself. And with Apple opening up the ability to compile apps for your own device using your own Apple ID rather than having to buy a developer account, it does give people the opportunity, if you can get your hands on an app on a Newton ROM ROM file, it gives people an opportunity to play with the Newton when maybe they haven't had the opportunity or the hardware previously.
Very cool. And we'll definitely put a link to the Einstein Project in show notes for this episode.
Yeah. I mean, I can't, take any credit at all. I mean, it's standing on the shoulders of giants. I think Paul Guillot was the original author, and it just boggles my mind what he accomplished in emulating, hardware that, we didn't have any documentation for. I mean, there was documentation out there somewhere, but, the community doesn't have it. And so, figuring out how all that worked is just amazing to me.
For me, the really big part about this most recent release was, for the longest time, the Linux binaries or the Linux source code wouldn't compile. So it was basically stuck on Mac OS X and iOS devices. And for me, working at MIT, one of my little pastimes is trying to compile software so that it can be shared with the rest of the MIT community. And so being able to get this on Linux and getting it on Raspberry Pi means that we can put it on hardware that it was never intended to be on, cheaper than an iPhone, for instance. And so in some people are getting excited by, you know, the fact that they can put it on a cheap touchscreen and maybe the Newton can live again or something like that. But I just am excited by the idea that more people can be exposed to it than would be if they had to buy an expensive Apple product.
Yeah, I actually bought a touchscreen display for my Raspberry Pi. I haven't gotten around to playing with it yet, but, you know, it's exciting that there was one silly bug that Steven identified that was causing a lot of problems. Not only for the, you know, Mac OS and iOS builds, but was really preventing it from booting on other platforms. And that one bug, I think, really opened up. And that's was what enabled that most recent release. And pretty exciting.
Yeah, all we need now is some enterprising 3D modeler to share plans to get a Raspberry Pi and basic touchscreen in a case that looks like a Newton.
Or just make an iPhone case that looks like one. There's a Kickstarter project for someone out there.
Someone did it. I've seen it. I don't know the history of it, but I have seen an iPhone case that either looks like or was made out of Newton parts.
Well, yeah, it's tempting for me also to go out and actually get some of the hardware since I've never really laid my hands on it. I feel like there's some argument to be made for, you know, like an eMate as the ultimate distraction free writing environment or something. who knows? Maybe I'll be forced to actually go onto eBay and check out the Newton in the flesh, as it were.
Yeah, the eMates are relatively inexpensive. I think, you know, they were meant for schools. And so, you know, I guess every once in a while a school cleans out a closet of these old things or something, and they go up on eBay relatively inexpensively. And if you're lucky, they even come with the RAM upgrade card or the flash upgrade card. So you get, it's still not quite a 2000, but with that added memory, you definitely get some better performance.
Yeah. I know that our school got one, we think just on loan for 2 weeks, and they said, yeah, we're not going to buy like a full lab full of these things. So, didn't wind up happening. And that was the only time that we got to see an eMate quickly go by. But they are really, I mean, they're of all of the platform, I mean, they're one of the weirdest devices, but also one of just the most beautiful devices. Really one of the coolest looking devices that Apple has ever made, to be honest.
Yeah, it's from before Johnny moved into his white room.
Yeah, it's very much TAM era, though.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has personality. And, you know, you can definitely see kind of in some of those early iBooks, kind of the same design style that kind of came from the eMate. But I don't think it was a very commercially successful product. I don't think it kind of sold very well from what I recall. But you can get them pretty expensive. Even MessagePad 2000 or 2100, you can find from time to time. Sometimes people have like a misconception of how much what they've got are worth, and they'll be like posted for exorbitant rates. But the hardest thing to get is a battery tray, because a lot of people back in the day invested in the NiCad battery pack, which are shot dead now. And so, you know, to have that battery tray that you could just put regular alkaline batteries in, sometimes that's the hardest part to come by.
Well, yeah. So Newton may not have been the most financially successful line for Apple, but it is really cool to see that it was, I think, a success in terms of advancing technology and technology that we're still all using today. So it was really great to hear some additional details on it, set the record straight on some of our hardware and software facts and figures, and to hear your experiences with it and how it's a small but vibrant community still going on today.
Thanks for having us. It's been fun to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, thanks to both of you. And so we're going to have lots of links to many of the things that were mentioned in this episode in our show notes, which are in the usual place in your podcast app or on our website at simplebeep.com/episodes. And for Jake and Thomas, where should we find you guys on the internet?
can find me at All About Jake on Twitter. I'm not really a prolific tweeter, but if I have something to say Newton related, that's where I usually post it. And actually recently just started a YouTube channel under the name Retro Newton, where I intend to post a couple how-tos to get people up and running with the development tools. So if someone wants to try their hand at building an app for the Newton, they can, you know, get a Sheep Shaver or Basilisk instance up and running, and the documentation is very well written. So, you know, just need to get past kind of that initial friction of getting a development environment, and then it's pretty easy to get started. So hoping that maybe we'll get some people interested.
Awesome. We'll definitely send people there. And Thomas, how about you?
Well, I'm Egg Freckles on Twitter and eggfreckles.net on the internet, and you'll know it when you see it.
You have a consistent brand. That is for sure.
Yeah.
You can find the show on Twitter as well. We're at simple_beep, and you can find me and Brian individually as well. I'm at ecormany, ecormany.
And I'm at bsuto, bsuto.
And thanks again to Jake Bordens and Thomas Brand for joining us, and we'll see you next time.